I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Gabriel.
Today is a special day on the Breaking Math podcast because we are collaborating with another educational creator. We'll be interviewing an author about a brand new book that was just released on September 18th called Mathematics with Mad Drawings. This book is by an author named Ben Orlin, who also writes a blog by the same name. Ben has had his writings in several journals, including the Atlantic, Slate, Vox, Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and now he's on the illustrious Breaking Math. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. Yeah, we are very glad to have you. Very, very, very exciting. I just got this book, Mathematics with Bad Drawings, and I'm thrilled to say to our audience, not only is there a lot of math in it, of course, but there are tons and tons of drawings. And we don't mean just math, you know, like diagrams and such. There's stick figures and cartoons and comics. It is an absolute delight to read.
Now, Ben, would you consider what you draw diagrams or cartoon, or what are they closer to, cartoons or diagrams?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think when I started the blog, so it was about 5 years ago now, I knew that to do math, it really helps to have visuals. You know, you guys do some inventive stuff with audio, but, you know, when I'm teaching, I know that when I have a good visual for something, that's when I can sort of get through to students. And so I knew I wanted to do drawings. I also knew that I can't draw. That is just not a skill that is in my skill set. And so I figured I should disavow it up front by calling the blog Math with Bad Drawings. So, you know, there are going to be drawings, and please don't set your expectations too high for them. So I think, you know, to answer your question, they're a little bit of both. I mean, they definitely have, the ones in the book are definitely there to help explain the ideas and to make it a little more lucid and easy to follow. And there's also a lot of jokes in them, and they're meant to be silly and playful.
So a question I want to ask you, with this book, now, of course, it's pretty obvious to me, or at least I think it is, what age group and what target audience is this book for specifically?
So I've been really happy with the feedback it's gotten from you know, math folks and sort of folks and math teachers and people who are already bought into math. But really, I mean, the audience it's most for is for adults who feel a little bit alienated from math or feel like they maybe had, you know, a bad breakup with math at the end of their educational trajectory and would like a chance to, you know, not to do a full reconciliation necessarily. That's hard to do in one book, but to at least have a nice experience with the subject and to get a chance to play around with some ideas.
Very good.
I saw that you did a very, what I call a good job of approaching statistics, where you start off by talking about the psychology of statistics, how a 1% chance in reality is what most people call a 6% chance.
Yeah, no, I think that's about right. Yeah, that I think this is research from Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is where I learned about it. And I think there's this whole, realm of kind of behavioral economics and behavioral psychology. Cognitive psychology. But so, yeah, so basically what happens is when people hear 99%, they tend to think of that as they kind of round down to like 95%, 90% maybe. When people hear 1%, they kind of round up to 5%, 6%, which I think helps explain why people react as sort of strangely as they do to tiny probabilities like lottery tickets and to almost one probabilities.
Interesting. Wow. When you taught, what was the age range that you taught?
Yeah, so I taught for 4 years in California, and I was teaching high school, so I did a lot of ninth grade when I started, and then mostly 11th and 12th after that. And then I taught for 3 years in the UK, where middle school and high school is just one big school.
Okay.
And so you're teaching 6 through 12.
Now, here's why I ask. As I was reading this, you know, what I read, I thought my middle schoolers would really, really enjoy. I know that you had mentioned that this is probably for adults who want to improve their relationship with mathematics. But would you also include, I don't know, down to, say, 7th grade or 6th grade, at least for parts of it?
Yeah, I think having taught 6th and 7th myself, I think the mathematical content would be accessible at that level. Because I think the fact is that most adults, when they go through the world, I mean, the dirty secret of math education is they go through and they're rarely using much from their math education past 6th or 7th, maybe 8th grade at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on a mathematical level, I think it should be accessible to those students. And I don't know as much about kind of the reading level of kids that age. So, but I think, you know, a good reader should be able definitely to dig in. And it's got pictures, so even if some of the jokes are going over your head, it should still be enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Just the humor throughout it. I would even say that anybody down to 6th grade or I don't want to say 5th grade and, you know, overstep it, but there's humor and depth for adults, and there's also accessibility for kids. I'm just saying, you know, like
yeah, no, I appreciate that. So someone on Twitter was telling me that they were at a bookstore and they saw a father and a kid who each had a book in hand. You know, the kid was maybe 10 and the father's grown up, and they're you know, trading back and forth of little things they're finding. So yeah, I think you know, I'm hopeful that it can be accessible for a wide range.
Especially if the parents read the book to their children, then it would be very, very enjoyable.
I do notice that the way that you've written this book, and I'm again using the probability chapter as an example because I thought it was very impressive, was you don't go much above base concepts. You don't really go, like, if you imagine math as a series of high rises, and you know, you have to go to the first floor to get to the second floor to get to the third floor, and on the top floor you have weird things like, I don't know, fiber bundles and Noether's theorem, but near the bottom you have a bunch of interesting stuff and a lot of lively activity going on. And I notice that you concentrate a lot on that and you get really deep into it. Like, can you tell us a little bit about, I really like the probability chapter on DNA.
Yeah. No, yeah, thanks. No, I'm glad that one stuck out to you. Yeah, definitely. What you're saying is definitely true, that mathematics is a very cumulative discipline. I mean, you know, everything builds on what came before. I think this is part of why people often have this experience of kind of falling off a cliff at some point with mathematics. It's not so much that they reach a point they can't handle. It's more that they reach a point where the last two or three steps, they kind of missed some pieces along the way. And so the next step just feels like too much, and they don't have quite the equipment to take it. So it's definitely true that math, as we experience in school, is very cumulative. And what I wanted to do in the book was try to avoid that by finding ways to keep connecting it back to reality, back to some kind of, you know, very tangible experience for people without getting too lost on, you know, building castles in the sky. So, right, the one you bring up is the chapter on coin flips and as sort of a model for how genetics works. So the chapter is about, it starts with the fact that I think you always notice if you're a teacher when you meet siblings and you meet parents, which is that it's just fascinating to see how people do and don't resemble each other. You know, you'll meet siblings who look like strangers, you'll meet cousins who look like twins, you'll meet two parents, and immediately you can see how, like, you know, you do a face mash in real time, and you're like, that is where that kid comes from. That is exactly a combination of those features of each parent. And so just starting from there, you know, that makes me curious about the genetics of inheritance and how, you know, how children inherit traits from their parents. And of course, you know, without going too deep into the biology, it's pretty simple is the wrong word for anything to do with genetics. But there's a very simple model that captures a lot of it, which is I've got 46 chromosomes. They come in 23 pairs. And I got, from each pair, I got one from my dad and one from my mom. And basically, how did I get those? You know, they each had 23 pairs. And when you have a kid, you flip a coin for each pair of chromosomes. And either you pass on the one you got from your mom or you pass on the one you got from your dad. You know, there's complexity, obviously, to inheritance. There's crossing over where you sort of combine the chromosomes. But that gets you a lot of the way towards understanding how inheritance works. And so you can really just think of it as coin flips. You know, your genome is 46 coin flips. It's 23 coin flips that your dad did and 23 coin flips that your mom did. And so just thinking about how coin flips work, I mean, that's kind of the simplest kind of probabilistic question that we have. And just looking at what happens when you flip coins, you can sort of get a surprising amount of insight about what happens when, you know, two people have a kid and when siblings will and won't look like each other.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about coin flips on TMI, our episode of Information Theory, and that's obviously highly related to DNA. And I just thought it was interesting the tack that you took. Gabriel, what was your favorite chapter that you read so far?
So far, and this is a popular one, this is actually the one that you suggested, I very, very much have enjoyed Chapter 10, the one where you talk about some of the mathematics behind the hypothetical design of the Death Star. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, full disclosure, part of that enjoyment was just the absolute hysterical humor that's in that chapter. Ben, I've read books by people who are very, very good at technical descriptions, and I've read books that are very, very entertaining. This is thoroughly, thoroughly entertaining. It reads where you interview Darth Vader and you interview the Imperial physicists who are discussing this this design. I mean,
and it's prosaic.
Do you any fan fiction or what kind of creativity are you involved in?
What spawned this?
Yeah, I don't think the Death Star chapter, I'm very proud of it. It was fun to sort of think about the mathematics of what would happen with a spherical space station if you really think about what are the implications of that. I don't think it rises to the level of decent fan fiction, because basically what I did is I thought up a bunch of things and then put them in the mouth of, you know, I just said, well, this is something an economist would say. So I said, the imperial economist then says, or this is something an architect would say. And so I said, the imperial architect then says. I'm not particularly well-versed in the fan fiction world, but I think that there's a little more world-building depth to most of that. Yeah, I mean, I've always liked writing. I've always liked making jokes and doing creative stuff. I do, you know, through my blog, I do a lot of cartoons that are, mostly just sort of silly. Try to avoid doing too many puns, because definitely when the mind is trying to think of jokes, puns are like the path of least resistance. But yeah, no, I've always enjoyed doing kind of silly creative stuff, and the book was definitely a good outlet for that.
I have to ask, just reading the book, were you inspired at all by the, I think it's a 1945 or 1955 book, How to Lie with Statistics?
You know, that's a book that I haven't read, but it's obviously, I mean, I know the title, I know of the book. It's such a, my guess is that I was influenced indirectly, because obviously I grew up in a culture that book helps to inform.
Yeah, because How to Lie with Statistics is a time-tested book that, just for our audience who hasn't heard of it, that it tells you essentially how people use statistics to warp our version of reality. And it's essentially kind of a math book. It's has less math than Ben's book, but it makes me think, honestly, that your book will stand the test of time. It's well written. From what I could tell, the editor knew what they were doing.
Yeah, no, I had a great editor. I was really happy with my editor. She's someone who's edited a fair number of science books and pop science books. But hasn't, I mean, I think part of why she was excited to take on the project was that, you know, she was kind of curious to see what I would say about math given a book to say it. And so she was really great about nudging me towards, I think particularly the books, what you were mentioning about the book being very grounded in reality. I think my editor, Becky Coe, definitely deserves a lot of credit for that, because my initial outline was a little more, you know, I had some stuff on prime numbers and kind of veering off a little bit more towards pure mathematics, which would have been, I think, fun to write about, but probably not as... not quite as accessible, and would have run into more problems of being accessible to a wide audience.
It sounds like that might be just a challenge for you in the future, because here at Breaking Math, but we don't think that anything is beyond the reach of anyone really in some form.
Isn't there a Feynman quote about that, where not only Feynman, but several others have said something along the lines of, if you can't explain something down to the level where people understand it, then you yourself don't really understand it?
I mean, I've always said that it takes forever to learn brain surgery, but you could tell me any fact about brain surgery, I'll probably remember it forever. So about your book, are there any chapters that you found difficult to write, not because they are difficult to explain, but because the concept was, I mean, I guess statistics would work with this, but like the concept was so not what people think it is?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in some ways the parts of the book that I sort of labored over the most and reworked the most were probably the opening chapter. So it begins with a section called How to Think Like a Mathematician. And particularly the first chapter uses this variant on tic-tac-toe called ultimate tic-tac-toe as a kind of entry point or a metaphor for how mathematicians think. And the idea is basically that mathematics is about playing with rules. And when you tweak the rules a little bit, you can get a whole new game. That chapter, I think probably, I mean, it makes sense because it's the opening chapter. That's probably the one that took the most work. And I think I remember being, I was probably 4 or 5 drafts deep into that and had what I thought was a really good draft. And I showed it to a friend who's a really bright guy, great editor, but not a mathematician. And he said, yeah, that was a fine piece of writing. I enjoyed that. You know, it had your jokes in it. I liked that. But at the end, I felt like I learned more about tic-tac-toe than I did about mathematics. And so I sort of needed to go back and figure out a way. I'd done only one half of the metaphor. I hadn't actually connected it to mathematics itself. And so I think to answer your question, the hardest parts of it were not so much addressing any particular mathematical concept, but trying to talk about mathematics in general, mathematics as a discipline. Because it's such a diverse and sprawling discipline, like any discipline, that it's hard to generalize about without slipping into falsehoods. And so those early chapters where I'm trying to talk about mathematics in general probably took the most finessing.
That's interesting. And it's nice how you paid that much attention to it. I think one of the only constants in mathematical research is a quote that I heard. Mathematics is like trying to get to the store and then ending up at your grandma's house and then ending up on the moon and then finally getting to the store.
Yeah, that rings true to me.
So this is one of my favorite questions that I like to ask anybody who is passionate about mathematics or science in general. Who are your favorite authors in the subject area?
That's a good question. So let's see. So So popular writers about mathematics, there's a lot that I think do great work. I really like. I'm almost hesitant to see who I list first. Anyway, so on my desk right now, I've got Hannah Fry's book about algorithms that I just finished, which I thought was a really nice book. Paul Lockhart, who wrote this this wonderful essay called it's known as Lockhart's Lament, but basically it's a sort of a polemic against the state of mathematics education as it is, which I found really influential. I think when I first read it, you know, I was 22 or 23, I sort of just started teaching. And then he has a really nice book called Measurement, which sort of lays out a lot of problems. Stephen Strogatz's book, Joy of X, is really wonderful. Jordan Ellenberg's book, How Not to Be Wrong, is really excellent. Simon Singh's writing about mathematics. He has a book about Fermat's Last Theorem that's really great. Siobhan Roberts has written two really wonderful biographies of mathematicians. Those are, yeah, I mean, I almost any time I pick up a, you know, the kind of book that shows up on the math shelf at the bookstore, I find something, you know, there's almost always something in that volume that I'm going to enjoy.
Now, who else? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, there's a few that I think we'll add to that. Jonathan, may I ask you, what is your all-time favorite book?
Oh, I don't. I mean, okay, actually, I kind of have one. I mean, how do you feel about Gödel, Escher, Bach as a science writer? Have you read it yet?
Yeah, I haven't read that book. I'm about like a third of the way through a collection of essays from Hofstadter. It's wonderful writing. He's a really flavorful, interesting, opinionated, brilliant writer.
Have you read a Person paper on purity and language?
Oh yes, I have. Yeah, his parody of Sapphire, right, is the name of the writer who is right. It's reflecting on gendered language, basically, but through a really
it swaps gender and race.
Yeah,
interesting. There's a few other ones, and actually, I was delighted to see that on your blog you listed a lot of the stuff that we read, including comics like XKCD, Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was one that we were just introduced to. It's the, what is it, the Star Codex? I'm saying it wrong.
Slate Star Codex.
I'm bad at remembering
Slate Star Codex. That's a phenomenal blog. Oh my goodness. There's one more that I wanted to mention. We've delved in recently. Are you familiar with the fan fiction Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality?
It's been on my to-read list for ages. Yeah, yeah. I know. I am familiar with it. I've heard really great things about it.
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. As I'm reading it, he quotes so many people. He talks about Richard Feynman. He talks about mathematicians. He talks about concepts in things like hedge fund managing. It's the author is just out of this world. We know that you spent some time as a teacher. We've got a few questions about education here. This was sent in by a coworker of mine who read the entire book. Her name is Kat. She's awesome. She writes, how do you respond when people say, oh, well, you're just good with numbers, so of course math makes sense to you?
Yeah, I think one assumption that's contained in there, which I think is very common among people who feel sort of slightly math averse, is that mathematics is all about numbers. I think knowing some people who are professional mathematicians and being a math teacher and knowing lots of other math teachers, many mathematicians like to disavow that idea that mathematicians are good at numbers. A lot of mathematicians I know like to sort of boast about how bad they are at arithmetic. I think it's a way of reorienting people's focus on, you know, mathematics is not arithmetic. It's not purely computation. It's about logic and it's about argument and it's about conceptualizing things and creating models of reality. And so, yeah, that tends to be my answer when people assume that mathematics is all about arithmetic. You know, that's one interesting and exciting part of mathematics, but there's a lot more to it.
What do you think that the process of learning math does to a brain, just in general? How does it infect the other ways of thinking?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it depends what kind of mathematics, but I think to me, one of the coolest possibilities of what math education can do is that it can be a really crisp and transformative education in logic. So this is, for example, Abraham Lincoln. You see it in the movie Lincoln, where he suddenly, at one or two points, he kind of rattles off some Euclid quotes, which is totally true to history because Lincoln loved Euclid. In fact, like in the middle of his legal studies, he kept coming across references to Euclid as just the model of how logic works. that somehow the arguments that Euclid laid out in his geometry book were the purest and the most certain sort of arguments that one could give. And so he actually kind of abandoned his legal studies and went back and for like 6 weeks just read math, read Euclid, and learned about geometric proof. And obviously Lincoln is someone, I mean, he became a lawyer, he became the best president we've had. You know, he was someone for whom argument was really central to what he did and what he contributed to the country. So to me, that's a pretty good, if you're gonna argue from anecdote, that's an anecdote I like to argue from. Because I think Lincoln understood that mathematics education could teach logic in a really profound way.
There is a subject that a lot of people think is really hard that obviously we call it geometry. And we have the best textbook that almost anybody's ever written for geometry. We've had it for 3,000 years, you know, the Elements. Why is that not used, in your opinion?
The geometry textbooks we have, I think, tend to draw from Euclid. They sort of rearrange the assumptions a little bit and fuss with it a little bit. And that's a good question of why is geometry still so hard to teach? I guess what it comes down to maybe is that having a great textbook doesn't constitute a great education. There are autodidacts out there. There are people who can learn from a book. But for most people, it takes a more interactive experience. You need someone talking to you one-on-one, seeing the work you're doing, responding to it, kind of leading you on the journey that is a learning experience or that is a class. And so the fact that Euclid wrote down this really definitive text 3,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, is a great resource, but doesn't constitute an education.
No, but I've looked at some geometry textbooks, and my mother used to be a science teacher and math teacher, yeah. And they don't seem like they cater much better to an educational experience. Like, I don't see what they do.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think the way I tend to think about curriculum is that it's not designed so much as it forms through natural processes. So, you know, what goes into a curriculum? Well, there are the pressures of, you know, there's probably some kind of design vision in an actual subject matter expert who was writing it. There's also going to be political officials, you know, whether they're state, you know, education board people or superintendents or whoever, who are applying some kind of political pressure on the curriculum writer. And, you know, not to say political pressure is a bad thing. It's the, you know, sometimes speaking with kind of the voice of parents collectively, or the voice of businesses, or the voice of citizens who have some kind of interest in it. Anyway, this is sort of a garbled explanation. But anyway, the way I think about curriculum is that a lot of different forces combine to shape it. And so looking for the single design behind curriculum often doesn't, it's very unsatisfying because we don't wind up finding a single design. What we wind up finding is that, well, this topic got included for that reason, and this topic got included for that reason, and the assessment takes this form because that person wanted the assessment to form this way. I think curricula in school tend to satisfy no one. And so it's not necessarily a simple matter of if one good designer could just come in and fix the math curriculum, because the math curriculum is serving a lot of different roles for society and then faces a lot of different pressures.
Which are the best pressures? Just kidding.
The pressures I'm applying.
We're going to ask you to rank everything on a linear scale.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. One variable always covers it.
Yeah. So another question about education, and this kind of, I think you sort of touched on this a little bit, but what do you find it to be the single most frustrating thing about teaching math?
Yeah, definitely the most frustrating experiences when you're teaching math is very simply when you're trying to teach something and the students are not managing to learn it. And that's frustrating for the teacher because you start to doubt yourself and the instruction that you're giving, and you start to want to blame the students. And it's frustrating for the students because they start to doubt themselves and their ability to learn it, and they want to blame the teacher. And it's really easy to get caught in this kind of dysfunctional cycle.
There's actually a blog of yours that I retweeted yesterday that I read, and I think it was it's one of your most popular ones. It's called "What It's Like to I'm gonna say it wrong. What It's Like to Not Be Very Good at Math."
Well, yeah, what it's like to be bad at math.
Yeah, that's one of your most popular blogs, isn't it?
Yeah. That was really early on in the blog. That was maybe the fifth or sixth post or something. So it was the first month that I've been doing the blog. And I mean, right, you know, it's like to sort of put something out on the internet. Put it out there, and it's not necessarily going to be a lot of feedback. And that one really took off. I think that really resonated with people because I sort of dug through my experience, And it was hard to write. I mean, I wrote, you know, when I sat down to write, I sort of wrote 500 words probably of like hedges and caveats that I had to delete later, explaining why I wasn't, this wasn't really a failure and that there were all good circumstances as to why I struggled in this class.
Interesting.
But then when I finally was able to force myself to write it, it was a piece about how I took this topology class and didn't get it. I really didn't. I wasn't able to grasp what the class was about. And, you know, I had to give this oral presentation that I was really ill prepared for. And sort of had to go groveling to the professor the day before to just ask for help and mercy. And it was, even, you know, a few years later writing about that, it was really surprisingly hard to bring myself to just, it was like looking at the sun, to just look right at that experience and what had I felt and why had I done what I did? Why had I reacted the way I reacted? Because it really stings when you're not getting something in mathematics. That's a really painful experience.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think that's something that, you know, being able to write that down and then throw some jokes in there, I think that resonated with people. Because almost anyone who's, if you spend long enough in a math classroom, spend long enough in math education, you're going to have that experience at some point or another.
We could do an entire podcast or a series of podcasts on math frustrations, I think, and it would relate very well, you know?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I should say that's a future episode. I feel like making an episode about math frustrations itself may be frustrating.
Maybe so. I think I might, you know, just as a little palate cleanser, we'll go to down here to the to one of the, what are your favorites? What are your favorite sci-fi stories? And that can be novels or comics or movies or shows. And why?
It's a tough question. So I think probably when it comes to TV shows, I still don't think there's a better science fiction show for me and in my heart than Star Trek: The Next Generation. I enjoy Deep Space Nine. I admire Deep Space Nine. It's got a lot of good things to it. Battlestar Galactica is a glorious show, I think. I'm one of the few people who will defend the finale. But Star Trek: The Next Generation, particularly once it gets going and once you get these episodes with Patrick Stewart, just getting at like the heart of what it is to be human. You know, moments when there's the episode, I mean, probably one of the best episodes of television that there's been, is the episode where a probe comes in and kind of zaps the captain, and suddenly he's in the life of this man on an alien planet. And over the course of the episode, he lives like 30 years on this alien planet. The episode's called The Inner Light, and experiences this whole life as this man with a different name on a different planet. And then at the end of the episode, he zaps back into his own body and has to then live the rest of the series with the memories of this life of this that he lived out in this lost civilization. That is a kind of story that you really can't tell in any other genre than science fiction and fantasy. I mean, and there's something that's able to say about what life is and what human experience is that more conventional fiction just can't go into that kind of territory.
Wow. I was going to say, it's pretty clear to me where Rick and Morty draws a lot of their plots and their subplots from. There's an episode all about that, but I think in this case, it's a video game.
Oh, yeah. Who's he supposed to be?
I'd forgotten about that. There is a moment in Rick and Morty like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, where he plays a guy who ends
Wait,
up
what's
working,
his name, though? The guy in... It's the name of the video game.
Oh, yeah. It's... Gosh, should we Google it real quick?
There's a moment. Rick and Morty takes, I would imagine, a virtually infinite number of influences and then condenses, you know, chops them up and condenses.
Oh, absolutely. So Jonathan's going to actually look the name of that one up. But yeah, I think in that episode, he's, you know, of course, born as a baby and lives as a man who ends up working at a carpet store. And and then I think he battles cancer and survives, and then he goes back to the carpet store or something, and then he ends up dying as an old
Roy.
It's called Roy.
Yeah, it's Roy. That's right. Right, and this all unfolds in like a minute and a half of screen time in the Rick and Morty episode.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is? I mean, I guess I know of a fiction that satisfies this criteria. It's the one that Gabriel's been bringing up. Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. And I guess some of Asimov's stories will fit this category too, but not just science fiction, but math-fi.
Yeah, I mean, I just read the first two Foundation books earlier this year. And I think, math fiction is something I've thought a lot about. There's a nice, I think someone, there's a nice website out there. If you just Google math fiction, someone's put together a really lovely database of all sorts of math fiction stories. I think Foundation by Asimov is probably one of the best examples. In Foundation, it's set in this kind of few millennia in the future, I don't know, 12,000 years in the future or something. The whole galaxy is populated by humans. It's this enormous population, this galactic empire, and it's about to fall. It's sort of patterned on the fall of Rome. And this one brilliant mathematician named Harry Seldon, through brilliant and slightly vague mathematics, is able to foresee the fall of this civilization and make just a little nudge, sort of put a few pieces into play that he thinks can, you know, won't be able to prevent the fall of the civilization, but will be able to shorten the dark age that follows. So instead of being a 30 millennium age of darkness where the galaxy is in turmoil, he thinks he'll be able to shorten it down to a single millennium. You know, it's much more a kind of civilizational adventure story than it is a story about mathematics, but at the heart of it is this idea that this one mathematical figure has somehow predicted millennia of galactic future using probability, basically.
Wow. Okay. There's plenty of more questions that I could easily grab any one of them. You know what? I thought I'd ask you, Ben, is there anything that you in particular would like to talk about, whether it is about your book or math in general or anything else?
No, you know, nothing leaps to mind. I mean, it's funny. When people ask me what I do right now, right at the moment, we are working on this book, and I've got a second book I'll be working on, that'll come out, in about a year. And then for doing interviews like this for this book, which are really fun, this has sort of become my full-time thing. But teaching has been the bulk of my career, and I still think of myself very much as a teacher. And so, right, I know you guys both have experience in math education too. But basically, I like to take every chance I get to just put in a good word for math education as a profession. I think particularly for people who are interested in technical fields, interested in mathematics, but also, you know, enjoy having a highly social work life, you know, to be around people all day. Math education is really pretty cool for that. And the world, you know, needs math teachers, will always need math teachers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, how do you think that math is universal or is not universal? And is it a language for the physical world, or is it a language for something deeper? Or is the idea of something deeper than the physical world itself in jest because it depends on the physical world to exist?
Yeah, I think it's funny. My understanding is if you talk to philosophers, you don't tend to find a lot of Platonists. Right? This idea that there's this magical, non-physical world of kind of pure objects, you know, pure geometric objects like triangles and things. Right. When it comes to Platonism, I don't think, from what I understand, most philosophers these days are not particularly Platonists. So, right, Platonism is kind of the idea, right? This idea of you've got forms that, you know, when you look at a chair and I look at a chair, I don't know, right now in the room I'm in, there are two chairs, and they're like pretty different. One of them is wooden, one of them is like IKEA, but somehow they're both chairs, right? They both have some essence of chairness to them. It's, you can sit on them, and they've got support below. And so Plato imagines that somehow there's a form of the chair, like the essence of chairness, and that there's this world. It's not our world, it's not the physical world, it's some other imaginary mind world where the forms all live. It was a cool idea when Plato thought of it. It doesn't seem to be something philosophers find very compelling today. But if you talk to mathematicians seem much, much more inclined towards that because it just feels true about triangles. Like, you know, I draw a triangle. It's not a perfect triangle. It's like a little wobbly. The corners aren't quite sharp and perfect. You know, you draw a triangle, same thing happens. We all draw different triangles. None of them quite feels like a perfect triangle. But we have this notion of a perfect triangle. It seems easy to imagine that it just feels like there's some kind of abstract idea that all of our broken earthly triangles are pointing at or gesturing at. So I think, you know, once you've had some experience with mathematics, it's really hard to resist that idea that there is some kind of deeper reality to logic, something that goes beyond the physical world.
Now, I just want to point out that you used chairs as an example, which we've done on Breaking Math, I think, 3 or 4 times.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think we used it for entropy. We keep using chairs.
The Big Bang Theory chairs did come up on that episode.
Oh, the big... what? what episode?
We were talking about how in the Big Bang Theory, when the singularity explodes, it's strange because it should be a uniform distribution of things, yet you still had an un...
Oh, yeah, like chairs.
Yeah, yeah. He mentions... Jonathan has these amazing leaps of logic. He's a brilliant person, but his leaps of logic are four or five steps ahead of ours. So he was talking about why it's a mystery with the Big Bang, how we have things like chairs. And we just thought, I'm sorry, I'm not following. So yeah, yeah, it was great conversation.
That's not my best
yeah.
moment on the show.
I like that the leaps of logic always bring it back to chairs too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So a few questions here. These are some that were submitted by Kat, actually. She says, now she has her degree in a field in biology. I believe it's biophysics. And she says, biology has a central dogma. Does math?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in short, no, math doesn't have a central dogma. I think if I had to name one, I mean, one that's comparable to the central dogma of biology, you know, the idea that, the central dogma is essentially the process of gene expression and inheritance, right? That's the central dogma of biology. So, I mean, the closest analogy I could think of in math, it's a fun parlor game to play. Like, what would you call the central dogma? To me, I think the Cartesian plane and the idea of, more generally that geometric objects can be expressed algebraically, and that algebraic relationships can be visualized geometrically. You know, the fact that you talk about the line y equals x, right? Y equals x is not a line, it's just saying two variables, x and y, are the same thing. They could be both 5, they could be both 10. And then you draw it on a coordinate plane, and suddenly it becomes this straight line passing through the origin with a slope of 1. And so the idea that there's a correspondence between the world of algebra and the world of geometry, you know, that doesn't get you all of mathematics, but there's an awful lot of mathematics that's only one or two steps removed from that basic insight.
So, of course, you care about math enough to write a book about it. You care enough about math to study it. Now, I guess the question is, and we do the same thing, kind of, why do any of this, and I don't mean that in, you know, in the absolute sense, like, why bother with life? I mean, why should mathematics be part of our world? What does it do to, and take the question how you'd like.
You know, when I hear other people answer that question or try to give the case for why math, I think you get two basic kinds of answers. And one answer is that math is super practical. You know, that math is how spreadsheets work, and it's how markets work, and it's how spaceships work. And so if you want to get things done in the world, you need math for all these practical reasons. And then the other answer you get is that math is beautiful, and math is patterns, and it's logic, and it's full of these lovely visuals that don't necessarily have to mean anything. They're just sort of expressions of the human intellect and the human spirit. What I find interesting, my answer to the question, is that if you notice, those two answers seem, if not opposites, then at least somewhat opposed, right? If math is a practical matter, then why would we expect it to be beautiful? And if math is about chasing beautiful ideas and following our curiosity, then there's no reason to expect it to be particularly practical. And yet it's both simultaneously all the time. There are all these weird cases where searching for the practical solution to some problem turns out some absolutely beautiful mathematics, or vice versa, searching for beautiful mathematics produces something of real practicality. You know, non-Euclidean geometry is probably my favorite example. This idea that you can come up with these imaginary geometries that don't seem to work the way regular geometry works. And those just sat there in mathematicians' minds for a few centuries, 150 years. And then suddenly Einstein came along and was able to demonstrate that those sort of weird imaginary geometries are actually the geometry of our physical reality. So to me, I mean, what's the case for mathematics? It's not just the practicality or the beauty, but the very weird way that math manages to be both simultaneously.
Yeah, I'm always reminded that you mentioned that of food. Food is absolutely necessary to sustain life, but also you have like 5-course restaurants.
Right, yeah, right. I look at my friends' pictures of stuff they're cooking on Instagram, and like, yeah, that looks like it would practically fulfill my hunger, and it is also just a beautiful thing to admire.
So math is food is what we're coming to the conclusion about.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, nutritious and lovely.
So if people wanted a bite of your book, because that was a clever thing to say, where can they do that?
Yeah, I mean, it should be available pretty much anywhere you like to buy books. So if you want to get it online, a big retailer, you want to go to Amazon, it's definitely available on Amazon. Barnes & Noble should have copies. Other bookstores should have copies too. If you got a favorite bookstore, go there. And if they don't have it, you can definitely request it and they'll get it for you.
Wonderful. Well, is there anything you'd like to say signing off?
No, I just thanks so much for the interview. It's really good talking to you guys.
I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Gabriel.
And this has been Breaking Math. So that was Ben with his new book, Math with Bad Drawings. And if you want to spend even more money on math-related things, what can they get from our Patreon?
We have, for our Patreons, for a one-time donation of $35, for our USA audience, a poster on tensors, which is the mathematics used in Einstein's general relativity.
Yeah, I mean, some of the mathematics, definitely. But we also are selling this internationally, but we're going to have to collect shipping. And just go to patreon.com/breakingmath to do that. If you want Gabriel to get a tattoo, you could email us at breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com. And you could see our Facebook at facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast.
That was the deal. What was it? 100 emails?
100 emails in two months.
In 2 months. And we are wrapping up. It'll be 2 months here pretty. It's the end of September, then the end of October. So.
Yeah. So start emailing.
Yeah. And I think the tattoo is going to be, it's going to be the information paradox equation and a cool symbol that goes with it. So we're going to do it and we're going to live, I don't know if we'll live stream it, but we will take pictures and tweet them out. So
we'll be sufficiently media saturated.
Okay. Very good.
Bye.